This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Our friends these days have been trash-talking us, as we'll talk about.
I think that's exactly right.
Including Rick Hess, formerly of the Education Gadfly Show.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Robert Sherman of the Education Reform Community, Kathleen Porter-McGee.
Thanks, Mike. I have absolutely no idea what that means.
Oh, though. My gosh. Did you not watch the football games over the weekend?
No, I didn't.
All right.
I am not a football girl.
All right. So in the game Seattle versus San Francisco, there was an amazing last minute play by Robert Sherman to tip the ball away from a receiver so that the 49ers did not score and win the game. His teammate caught the ball for an interception. And then he proceeded to trash talk the guy that he just kept the ball from. And then he went on live TV and continued to trash talk after that. Now, as we will discuss, though, you're not really. I'm not saying you're the trash talker. It would really be more fair to say that some of our friends these days have been trash talking us, as we'll talk about.
I think that's exactly right.
Including Rick Hess, formerly of the Education Gadfly Show. All right, lots to cover today. Pamela, let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
This week, Fordham is releasing a brand new ebook called Knowledge at the Core, Don Hirsch, Core Knowledge, and the Future of the Common Core. Among other things, it describes the potential for Common Core to bring core knowledge to many more schools, but it's not sanguine about it actually happening. Why?
Yeah, so Kathleen, look, I think for both of us, one of the main reasons that we really like the Common Core standards, why Don Hirsch likes the Common Core standards, is because they call for a content-rich curriculum in the elementary school grades. They call for it, but they can't make it happen.
Right.
And what we see so far is no indication at all that anybody's actually doing anything about this call.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, I think that's the challenge of implementation. You can set standards. We've always said setting standards is only as good as its implementation. And so far, I understand why people are apprehensive about the implementation of Common Core.
Look, in this new ebook, Ruth Wattenberg wrote a chapter where she goes in and she tries to look at some of the newer textbooks and Basel readers, some of the things online on states' websites, and it is hard to see. It doesn't seem like anybody's paying attention to this idea of a content-rich curriculum. They are aligning things to the skills that are in the Common Core, and that's better. They're pretty good. But they don't seem to be getting the message.
Yeah, it's only marginally better, right? Because the biggest lesson that we should have learned about reading instruction from the NCLB era is that skills divorced from content doesn't get the job done.
No, right. So what is up with this? We know from another paper in the book by Steve Farkas that educators aren't ideologically opposed to the idea of content. I mean, we have those debates maybe in the ivory tower, but the teachers don't. They like the idea. Let's teach history, science, literature, music, art in the elementary grades, but it's not happening.
You know, I think it's about more than just content. I think if you asked most teachers, they would say they are teaching content. I think the thing that core knowledge brings is both content and coherence. Okay. So it's actually a very, very systematically teaching particular content over each grade level across all grades, K through five, I guess. And, when you talk to teachers, and even when you talk to a lot of education experts, like I remember Grant Wiggins wrote about this recently, where he said, I've never been into a school where they aren't teaching content, but I think they're teaching content in a very decontextualized way, and that's not helping students, and it's not helping their reading comprehension.
And it doesn't seem front and center. I mean, look, as I can try to get a sense of what most elementary school curriculum looks like, it just seems pretty vacuous. I mean, there's just not, but when you look at some, like in the District of Columbia, they're doing a really good faith effort to try to redesign their curriculum around coherent content. And so they say, okay, we're going to have a 3-week unit on some historical topic, let's say Native Americans. And then we're going to have a 3-week topic on a scientific topic of, and this is in the English language arts block, right? And then they pick out texts about that subject and that are appropriately challenging. And so they are teaching kids about the world. They're also teaching them how to read together, unified. That's the whole idea. This is dramatically different than what you see in most places. And again, the mystery is why? Why is this so hard to get this message across? And if we can't get the message across, it seems like we've lost one of the great benefits of the Common Core.
Well, and I think that you got at an additional problem. You're talking about, DCPS really doing this within the ELA block. Again, core knowledge is an entire approach to elementary school instruction. Yeah. It's not just an approach to literature or to literacy. And so I think that schools haven't embraced changing the way they teach their entire elementary right. curriculum. And I think that's one of our challenges.
All right, Pamela, topic number two.
Over the weekend, Rick has blasted the two of you for not being angrier at Arne Duncan for urging college presidents to back the Common Core. What was that about?
Yeah. So hold on. Let's unpack that again. Okay. Yeah. So Arne Duncan gave a speech at this White House summit last week about access to college, saying, among other things, that, hey, college presidents, get on board with the Common Core. This is going to help you get kids who are better prepared to succeed at college that might, you know, make remedial education a thing of the past. Right. And so, you know, hooray for the Common Core. All right. And then Rick said, aren't you Common Core supporters upset that he said these things? To which we said, yes, we would like Arne Duncan to stop talking about the Common Core. It is not helpful, and it is helping people make the case that it's a federal intervention. But we've been screaming at him again and again, and none of that matters. And then Rick rose and writes this piece saying, well, you're not angry enough. You seem to be excusing it because we said some things like, look, you know, what are we supposed to do? And hey, how different is it from other secretaries of education using the bully pulpit to promote their agenda?
Right. I mean, this is the first education secretary to really use the bully pulpit to his advantage was Bill Bennett. And so we should not be surprised to see the secretaries that have followed him really following in his lead. I don't think, yes, do we all wish that Arne Duncan would stop talking about the Common Core? 100% yes. I mean, this is something actually that you've been saying for many, many years now.
And I've been sending, I mean, both publicly, privately. I mean, yeah. I feel like every day I'm sending some nasty gram to the Department of Education right. saying, shut up.
Yeah. It turns out they tend not to listen.
They tend not to listen. Right. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, I still do believe that the origin of the Common Core, it was state initiated. If we don't want to use the word state led anymore, it was created, you know, by state leaders, or at least initiated by state leaders. You know, it was incentivized by Race to the Top. So were a number of other things like charter schools, like teacher evaluation. Do we wish that the federal government would take a more hands-off approach to K-12 education? Yes, we absolutely do. And that extends beyond standards. Yeah. We wish they would take a hands-off approach to all kinds of things, teacher evaluation chief among them. Right. Again, they have intended to listen, and that doesn't change our stance on standards and accountability-driven reform.
So again, to be clear, Rick, yes, we do not want Arne Duncan talking about the Common Core, okay? Because it fuels this conspiracy theory that this is a federal intervention, which it is not, right?
Exactly.
That this started as a state-led effort. It is back with the states. There was a federal incentive. We wish there wasn't, but mm-hmm. that happened, and it happened in the past. What I'm trying to understand about this argument is say, look, okay, is it because Arne Duncan has so much power that he's not allowed to say anything or without turning it into a federal intervention? I mean, Rick wrote about how these college presidents have all this financial aid at risk, so they were going to toe the party line. I don't know. That was true in the Bennett days, too. Right. So, but we didn't. I mean, back then, people just kind of assumed that most of the education system just ignored whatever Bill Bennett said because, you know, that's what they did. I just don't quite get it. But it certainly feels like we have this dynamic where some policy wonks are trying to prove their, I don't know, conservative bona fides mm-hmm. or something. Look, the Common Core have been now in place for 3.5 years. All right. We're a year out from the first assessments. We all know that there's a million things that could go wrong and a million things that got to get right. Some of us are trying to get in there and get our hands dirty and try to make this thing work and also keep the feds out of it.
Right.
And we would appreciate if our friends would join us in that fight
right.
instead of trash talking like Robert Sherman. See, it comes full circle.
Right, exactly. And I wish we'd also keep our vigilance forward-looking and not, you know, looking behind us. I mean, there are things that we need to continue to be cautious about, and we need the federal government to you know, step away from its heavy-handedness. And so as we look towards ESEA reauthorization and a whole host of things, mm-hmm. we should be really working to make sure the federal stamp is lessened.
Yeah. All right, good. You know, I hope Joe, you know, our producer Joe here, now that we're doing video, I think what would be cool is if we could take that video of Robert Sherman trash talking and put Rick's head on top of
right.
it. that would be very effective. Okay, Pamela, question number three.
Florida is looking to add dozens of new standards to the Common Core. Is this a good idea? Will it make the standards better or satisfy the opposition?
What do you think, Kathleen? Pretty interesting.
So some very different questions. I mean, is it a good idea for states to customize or strengthen the core to meet the particular needs of their schools, their teachers, and their students? Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
That's something that I know I personally said, and I think we said at Fordham long before this became a politicized issue. We said in, I believe, 2010, states need to take seriously when they're adopting the Common Core that the additional content that they need to add to customize it for mm-hmm. their states. So I'm glad to see that more states are taking that seriously right now. Will it satisfy the opposition? I mean, it seems unlikely,
right.
You know, I mean,
right.
The opposition believes that anything about the Common Core, any shred of evidence that we are remaining faithful to the essential principles in the Common Core, that's going to be something that they just need to reject.
I mean, let's talk about some of the changes. My understanding was it in the lower grades, it did some things like saying kids need to learn cursive writing.
Yes, we had cursive. Yep.
Right. Okay. And I think at the higher grades, I think in Florida, but maybe in some other places, they've talked about having the math standards go further. And this has been a big debate. You know, I think we've all been clear that the math standards and the English standards are written to get to a college ready level. That means a 4-year public university or a community college that can transfer to a 4-year college, not needing to take remedial education, which is a much higher standard than we've had in almost every place before. But let's face it, that does not mean a high enough standard for a selective college or for an engineering major or another STEM field, because, you know, the standards go through basically Algebra 2. Clearly, somebody who's going into those great, you know, going into selective colleges or STEM fields, they should be going through calculus.
Right.
Now, this Common Core says, look, we're a floor, not a ceiling. And so states say, yeah, if you want to add, you know, these other pieces to it, pre-calculus, calculus, go for it. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Florida did. They added calculus standards. Great.
And people say, well, but they're not going to be assessed. Well, they could be. You could have end of course exams if you wanted to.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, in those subjects. Now, something like cursive, it is fair to say, is not going to be assessed by, say, Park or Smarter Balanced.
And of course, in the past, it hasn't been assessed either. So,
Right.
Not a Common Core issue specifically.
Very interesting. I mean, all these years, we have not been finding out if
we
kids can write cursive.
We haven't been systematically assessing cursive.
Can you still write in cursive, Kathleen?
Sort of. It's really messy.
I have to say no.
Yeah,
no for
it,
me. You can read it.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of people, their pushback against cursive is that you won't be able to read, say, the original founding documents.
Oh, I see.
Because you can't actually make sense out of it.
Interesting. Huh. All right. So let's do that. I'm for that. I want us to be able to read the original founding documents.
Absolutely.
In the original cursive.
Yes, absolutely. Common Core doesn't prohibit it.
Yeah. Do they have those old English words in there too?
Yeah, exactly.
Know?
Ye old.
Ye old. Yes. Teach that stuff too. All right. That is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Pamela. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, do you think that Robert Sherman was out of line in his comments?
I do. I got so aggravated with that guy. And then there was this Huffington Post piece earlier. I don't know if you guys already talked about this. But
I didn't even know who
they defended him because I guess he got a 4.2 GPA and he went to Stanford and they're like, we're just mad because he's he was raised in the ghetto and he succeeded. And that's what people are mad about. I'm like, what? We're mad because he was an idiot and kids look up to these guys even though they shouldn't, but they do.
And he was an idiot because he was not exactly being sportsmanlike.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Come on. You learn that when you're a kid, right? I mean, I played softball. I don't care. We lost miserably. We went out in the field and we shook the hands of the other team. My dad was my coach. We made it. Sometimes we were mad. We didn't want to be shaking their hands because they just beat us into the dirt, but we did.
I love it. I love it. That's a lesson. You can trash talk during the game if it helps you win, but after the game, Zip it. Okay, but don't zip it, you, Amber, because we are excited for your research minute.
Woohoo! All right, we got a good question here. There's been some research on this, but the question is, does the poverty level of a school impact how much a teacher improves or not over time? So that's the focus of a Calder paper. It's called Teacher Performance Trajectories in High and Lower Poverty Schools. You guys are looking perplexed already. Analysts focused on elementary school math teachers in fourth and fifth grade in self-contained classrooms in North Carolina and Florida. So they looked at 11 years of data in North Carolina. They looked at 8 years in Florida. The bottom line, they found no systematic relationship between a school's poverty rate and how teachers performed over time. as measured by value added scores, right? So there's a question like, if you're in a high poverty school, does that inhibit your growth as a teacher? Right. In both high poverty schools, that was defined as over 60% of students are on free and reduced lunch. In low poverty schools, that's less than 60%. Teacher performance improves fastest in the first 5 years. We've heard this so many times. And then it flattens out in years 5 to 10. Teacher performance growth resumes. This is kind of interesting. In North Carolina, between years 10 and 15. So they get another bump in North Carolina. Huh. But it remains flat in Florida. We don't know why. In both school poverty settings, though, there's significant variation in teacher improvement over time. So whether you're a novice, an early, or a mid-career teacher, it doesn't matter. The fastest improving teachers in each stage gain the equivalent of more than a half a year of performance growth annually than the slow performing teacher. So there's huge difference no matter what stage your career, if you're, you know, kicking butt. But again, such variations are not correlated, but it's not correlated to poverty status. Okay. So anyway, it doesn't, the study basically says, you know what, you know, that there's no evidence here, at least, that the poverty status is impacting teacher growth.
And this is important because in a place like DC, with the impact system, what they found was that more teachers in the wealthier schools got high marks. And the question was, you know, is that because those teachers really were better teachers, or was it just unfair that somehow it was easier to show more value-added gains in those wealthier schools? And this study would say, no, it wasn't. Now, what it means is that we have a teacher inequity problem in D.C. where, you know, we do have more effective teachers over in the wealthier schools. And that's something that we need to address.
But I mean, one thing, which I thought was interesting in the discussion here, is that it doesn't mean that schools can't impact a teacher's growth at all, you know, because there have been studies that show if you have a supportive teaching environment, you know, and they measure that through surveys and other things, that it can advance teacher growth. So it's not like the school is a non-player in helping teachers to improve, but it just happens that this study didn't show anything with the poverty level.
Hey, do you guys know, I mean, when we look at these years of experience indicators, have people untangled that from age at all? Like, I wonder if it if it holds, if it's the same dynamic, whether the teacher starts at age 22 or 32
like
or 42.
Like a mid-career switcher. Yeah.
Partly, here's one question I would love for us to study, is what happens when teachers become parents? Right. I mean, you saw that plateauing effect. I wonder if Bart, that it means they have little babies at home and they're not getting any sleep. That's why they're not making any progress. And then once their kids are school age, they get to be more effective again. I do wonder, I mean, just thinking about this experience as a dad, you know, I feel like, oh my gosh, I'd be such a better teacher now that I've had the experience of being a dad and knowing what it's like to, you know, be around little kids and understanding them much better than I ever could have at 22. I don't know. I'm just curious how that.
I mean, this one didn't do it. They just did early, mid, later, but they didn't do it by age.
It's an idea for a forum study.
It is. It is. Although I would think the slump has more to do with you've been doing the same thing and probably being developed professionally the same way for X number of years. And so you plot, because there's only so many, you have to change it up, right?
Right.
You just keep doing the same thing. Eventually you'll get as good as you're going to get with that method. And you need to do something different, I would think, to push to the next
level.
Are
those kids, right? Like some teachers who want to keep growing, say I've taught 8th grade for 15 years. I like to switch 11th grade, you know? And they do.
It's
and
a new challenge. Yeah, something to kind of get you out of.
I think you're downplaying the importance of sleep.
Oh, God,
I mean, come on, you remember this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how could you be a good teacher when you're up half the night with your baby?
I don't know.
Or do anything. I mean,
well, there you go. Yes, indeed. Okay. Well, good. Interesting stuff. Thank you. You know, Calder, I have to say, they are right up there with NBER.
They are. All right. And this is Mike Hansen. Shout out to Mike Hansen.
Mike Hansen.
Who,
he is
one of our EAPS or peeps.
He's an EAPS peep. Yep. Love it. All right. Good. Well, thank you, Amber.
You're welcome.
That is all the time we have for this week. So until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.